looked as if he were drawing something complicated in mid-air, didn't it? Blomqvist was starting to see the whole scene in a new light. Maybe it was not Franz Balder who had drawn the traffic light after all. Perhaps the boy had a gift. For some reason that did not surprise him as much as he might have expected. The first time he had met August Balder, sitting by his dead father, and seen him throwing himself against the headboard, he had already understood there was something exceptional about him. Now, as he cut across Mariatorget, a strange thought occurred to him and would not let him go. Up by Jutsgardsbakken, he came to a stop. He must at the very least follow it up, so he got out his mobile and looked up Hanna Balder. The number was unlisted and unlikely to be one which he would find in Millennium's contacts. He thought of Freya Grunliden, a society reporter at Expressen, whose columns did not do much to enhance the prestige of the profession. She wrote about divorces and romances and royalty, but she had a quick brain and a sharp wit, and whenever they met, they had a good time together. He rang her number, but it was engaged, of course. These days, reporters on the evening papers were forever on the telephone, under such deadline pressure that they never left their desks to take a look at what real life was like. But he got her in the end, and was not in the least surprised that she let out a yelp of delight.
"Mikael," she said, "what an honour! Are you finally going to give me a scoop? I've been waiting for so long."
"Sorry, this time you have to help me. I need an address and a phone number."
"What do I get in return? Maybe a wicked little quote about what you got up to last night?"
"I could give you some career advice."
"And what might that be?"
"Stop writing crap."
"Right. Then who's going to keep track of all the telephone numbers the Class C reporters need? Who are you looking for?"
"Hanna Balder."
"I can imagine why. Did you meet her drunken boyfriend out there?"
"Don't you start fishing now. Do you know where she lives?"
"Torsgatan 40.
"You know, just like that.
I have a brilliant memory for trivia. If you hang on, I'll give you the front door code and the phone number as well."
"That's really kind."
"But you know..."
"Yes?"
"You're not the only one looking for her. Our own bloodhounds are on the hunt, too, and from what I hear, she hasn't answered her telephone all day."
"Wise woman."
Afterwards Blomqvist stood in the street, unsure what to do. Chasing down unhappy mothers in competition with crime reporters from the evening papers was not quite what he had hoped his day would bring. But he hailed a taxi and was driven off in the direction of Vatastan. Hanna Balder had accompanied August and Forsberry to Odin's Medical Centre for Children and Adolescents opposite Observatory London on Sveavägen. The medical centre consisted of two apartments which had been knocked together, but even though the furnishings and the courtyard had a private and sheltered feel to them, there was nonetheless something institutional about it all. Probably that had less to do with the long corridors and closed doors than the grim and watchful expressions on the faces of the staff. They seemed to have developed a certain distrust of the children for whom they were responsible. The director, Torke Linden, was a vain little man who claimed to have a wide experience of children with autism. But Hanna did not like the way he looked at August. It was also troubling that there seemed to be no separation between teenagers and small children. But it felt too late to be having doubts now, so on the way home she consoled herself with the thought that it would only be for a short time. Maybe she would pick August up as soon as this evening. Then she thought about Lasse and his bouts of drunkenness, and she told herself yet again that she needed to leave him and get a grip on her life. As she stepped out of the lift at her apartment, she gave a start. An attractive man was sitting there on the landing, writing in a notebook. As he got to his feet and greeted her, she saw that it was Mikael Blomqvist. She was terrified, so guilt-ridden that she supposed he was going to write some kind of exposé. That was absurd. He just gave an embarrassed smile and twice apologized for disturbing her. She could not help but feel a huge sense of relief. She had admired him for a long time.
"I have no comment to make," she said,
in a voice which actually suggested the opposite.
"I'm not after a quote either," he said.
She remembered hearing that he and Lasse had arrived together, or at least at the same time, at France's the previous night, although she could not imagine what the two of them might have in common.
"Are you looking for Lasse?" she said.
"I'd like to hear about August's drawings," he replied,
and at that she felt a stab of panic. Yet she allowed him in. It was probably careless of her. Lasse had gone off to cure his hangover in some local dive, and could be back at any time. He would go crazy if he found a journalist in their home. But Blomqvist had not only worried Hanna, he had also made her curious. How on earth did he know about the drawings? She invited him to sit on the grey sofa in the living room while she went to the kitchen to get some tea and biscuits. When she came back with a tray, he said, "I wouldn't be bothering you if it wasn't absolutely necessary."
"You're not bothering me," she said.
"You see, I met August last night, and I haven't been able to stop thinking about him."
"Oh?"
"I didn't understand it then," he said, "but I had the feeling he was trying to tell us something. Now I'm convinced he wanted to draw. He was making these determined movements with his hand over the floor."
"He's become obsessed with drawing."
"So he continued here at home?"
"And how? He started the minute we got here. He was manic, and what he drew was amazing. But his face became flushed, and he was breathing heavily, so the psychologist said he had to stop. It was compulsive and destructive, was his opinion."
"What did he draw?"
"Nothing special, really. I'd guess it was inspired by his puzzles. But it was very cleverly done, with shadows and perspective and everything."
"But what was it?"
"Squares."
"What kind of squares?"
"Chessboard squares, I think you would call them," she said.
Maybe she was imagining things, but she detected a trace of excitement in Blomqvist's eyes. "Only chess squares?" he said. "Nothing more?"
"Mirrors, too," she said. "Chessboard squares reflected in mirrors."
"Have you been to France's place?" he said,
a new sharpness in his voice. "Why do you ask?"
"Because the design of the floor in the bedroom, where he was killed, looks just like chessboard squares, and they're reflected in the mirrors of the wardrobe."
"Oh, my God."
"What's the matter?"
"Because..."
A wave of shame washed over her.
"Because the last thing I saw before I snatched the drawing away from him was a menacing shadow emerging out of those squares," she continued.
"Do you have the drawing here?"
"No. Or rather, yes."
"Yes?"
"I'm afraid I threw it away. But maybe it's still in the bin."
Blomqvist had coffee grounds and yogurt all over his hands as he pulled a crumpled piece of paper out of the trash can and smoothed it out on the draining board. He brushed it with the back of his hand and looked at it in the glare of the kitchen lights. The drawing was not finished, not by any means, and it consisted mostly of chessboard squares, just as Hannah had said, seen from above or from the side. Without having been in Balder's bedroom, it would not be obvious that the squares represented a floor, but Blomqvist immediately recognized the mirrors on the wardrobe to the right of the bed. He also recognized the darkness, that special darkness that had met him during the night. He felt transported back to the moment when he had walked in through the broken window, apart from one small, important detail. The room he had entered had been almost dark, whereas the drawing showed a thin source of light falling diagonally from above, extending out over the squares. It gave contours to a shadow which was not distinct or meaningful, but which felt eerie, perhaps for that very reason. The shadow was stretching out an arm, and Blomqvist, who saw the drawing in a different light from Hannah, had no trouble interpreting what that signified. The figure meant to kill. Above the chessboard squares and the shadow, there was a face which had not yet materialized. "Where is August now?" he said. "Is he sleeping?"
"No, I've left him with someone else for a while. I couldn't handle him, to be honest."
"Where is he?"
"At Odin's Medical Center for Children and Adolescents, on Sveavägen."
"Who knows that he's there?"
"No one."
"Just you and the staff?"
Hannah nodded.
"Then he has to stay that way. Will you excuse me for a moment?" Blomqvist took out his mobile and called Poblansky. In his mind, he had already drafted yet another question for Lisbeth's staff. Poblansky felt frustrated. The investigation was going nowhere. Neither Balder's black phone nor his laptop had been found, so they had not been able to map his contacts with the outside world, despite having had detailed discussions with a service provider. For the time being, they had little more than smoke screens and clichés to go on. Poblansky thought a ninja warrior had materialized swiftly and effectively, and then vanished into the darkness. In fact, the attack had something far too perfect about it, as if it had been carried out by a person free of all the usual human failings and contradictions which, as a rule, feature in a murder. This was too clean, too clinical, and Poblansky could not help thinking that it had been just another day at the office for the killer. He was pondering this and more besides when Blomqvist rang.
"Oh, it's you," Poblansky said. "We were just talking about you. "'We'd like to have another word with you as soon as possible.'
"'Of course, not a problem. But right now I've got something much more important to tell you.
"'The witness, August Balder, is a savant,' Blomqvist said.
"'A what?
"'A boy who may be severely handicapped, but nonetheless has a special gift. "'He draws like a master, with a remarkable mathematical sharpness. "'Did you see the drawings of the traffic light which were lying on the kitchen table in Saltshawbaden?'
"'Yes, briefly. "'Are you saying it wasn't Balder who drew them?'
"'It was the boy.
"'They looked like astonishingly mature pieces of work,
but they were drawn by August. "'This morning he sat down and drew the chessboard squares on the floor in his father's bedroom, and he didn't stop at that. "'He sketched a shaft of light and a shadow. "'My theory is that it's the killer's shadow and the light from his headlamp, but of course we can't yet say for certain. "'The boy was interrupted in his work.'
"'Are you pulling my leg?
"'This is hardly the moment.
"'How do you know all this?
"'I'm at the home of the boy's mother, Hannah Balder, "'and I'm looking at the drawing. "'The boy's no longer here. He's at—'
"'The journalist hesitated.
"'I don't want to say more than that over the phone.
"'You say that the boy was interrupted in the middle of his drawing?
"'A psychologist stopped him.
"'How could one do something like that?
"'He probably didn't realize what the drawings represented. "'He just saw them as something compulsive.' I suggest you send some people over right away. You've got your witness.
We'll be there as soon as we can.
Jan Bublansky ended the call and went to share Blomqvist's news with the team, though soon after he wondered whether this had been wise. Chapter 15 November 21st Salander was at the Rauscher Chess Club on Helsingegatan. She did not really feel like playing. Her head was aching. She had been on the hunt all day long. But the hunt had taken her here. When she realized that Franz Balder had been betrayed by one of his own, she had promised him she would leave the traitor alone. She had not approved of the strategy, but she had kept her word, and only when Balder had been killed did she feel absolved of her promise. Now she was going to proceed on her own terms. But it was not all that easy. Arvid Vranger had not been at home. And instead of calling him, she wanted to strike down on his life like a bolt of lightning, and had therefore been out searching for him, her hoodie pulled over her head. Vranger lived the life of a drone. But as with so many other drones, he had a routine, and Salander had been able to find a number of signposts through the trail of pictures he posted on Instagram and Facebook. Risha on Birja Jelsgarten, and the theatre grill on Nibrogarten, the Rauscher Chess Club, and Café Ritorno on Odengarten. And a number of others, including a shooting club on Friedhelmsgarten, plus the addresses of two girlfriends. Vranger had changed since the last time she had him on her radar. Not only had he gotten rid of his nerdy look, his morals were also at an ebb. Salander was not big on psychological theory, but she could see for herself that his first major transgression had led to a succession of others. Vranger was no longer an ambitious student eager to learn. Now he was addicted to porn. And bought sex online, violent sex. Two of the women had afterwards threatened to report him. The man had a fair amount of money. He also had a load of problems. As recently as that morning he had googled Witness Protection Sweden, which was careless of him. Even though he was no longer in contact with Solifon, at least not from his computer, they were probably still keeping an eye on him. It would be unprofessional not to. Maybe he was beginning to crack up beneath the new urbane exterior, which served her purpose. When she once again rang the chess club, chess being the only connection with his former life, she was pleasantly surprised to hear that Vranger had just arrived there. So now she walked down the small flight of steps on Helsingegatan and along a corridor to some shabby premises where a motley crowd of mostly older men were sitting hunched over their chessboards. The atmosphere was somnolent. And nobody seemed to even notice her, let alone question her presence. They were all busy with what they were doing, and the only sound was the click of the chess clocks and the occasional swear word. There were framed photographs of Kasparov, Magnus Carlsen, and Bobby Fischer on the walls, and even one of a pimply, teenaged Arvid Vranger, playing the chess star Judit Polgar. A different, older version of him was sitting at a table, further in and to the right, and he seemed to be trying out some new opening. Next to him were a couple of shopping bags. He was wearing a yellow lambswool sweater with a freshly ironed white shirt and a pair of shiny English shoes, a little too stylish for the surroundings.
Salander approached him with careful, hesitant steps and asked if he would like a game. He responded by looking her up and down, then he said,
"Okay."
"Nice of you," she replied, like a well-mannered young girl, and sat down. She opened with E4. He answered with B5, the Polish gambit, and then she closed her eyes and let him play on. Wrange tried to concentrate on the game, but he was not managing too well. Fortunately, this punk girl was going to be easy pickings. She wasn't bad, as it turned out. She probably spent a lot of time playing. But what good was that? He toyed with her a little, and she was bound to be impressed. Who knows? Maybe he could even get her to come home with him afterwards. True, she looked stroppy, and Wrange did not go in for stroppy girls, but she had nice tits, and he might be able to take out his frustrations on her. It had been a disaster of a morning. The news that Balder had been murdered had floored him. It wasn't grief that he felt. It was fear. Wrange really did try hard to convince himself that he had done the right thing. What did the goddamn professor expect when he treated him as if he didn't exist? But of course it wouldn't look good that Wrange had sold him down the river. He consoled himself with the thought that an idiot like Balder must have made thousands of enemies. But deep down he knew. The one event was linked to the other. And that scared him to death. Ever since Balder had started working at Solifon, Wrange had been afraid that the drama would take a frightening new turn. And here he was now, wishing that it would all go away. That must have been why he went into town this morning on a compulsive spree to buy a load of designer clothes, and had ended up here at the chess club. Chess still managed to distract him, and the fact was that he was feeling better already. He felt like he was in control and smart enough to keep on fooling them all. Look at how he was playing. This girl was not half bad. In fact, there was something unorthodox and creative in her play, and she would probably be able to teach most people in here a thing or two. It was just that he, Arvid Wrange, was crushing her. His play was so brilliant and sophisticated that she had not even noticed he was on the brink of trapping her queen. Stealthily he moved his positions forward, and snapped it up without sacrificing more than a knight. In a flirty, casual tone, bound to impress her, he said, "Sorry, baby, your queen is down." But he got nothing in return. No smile, not a word, nothing. The girl upped the tempo, as if she wanted to put a quick end to her humiliation. And why not? He'd be happy to keep the process short and take her out for two or three drinks before he pulled her. Maybe he would not be very nice to her in bed. The chances were that she would still thank him afterwards. A miserable cunt like her would be unlikely to have had a fuck for a long time, and would be totally unused to guys like him, cool guys, who played at this level. He decided to show off a bit and explain some higher chess theory, but he never got the chance. Something on the board did not feel quite right. His game began to run into some sort of resistance. He could not understand. For a while he persuaded himself that it was only his imagination, perhaps the result of a few careless moves. If only he concentrated, he would be able to put things right, and so he mobilized his killer instinct. But the situation just got worse. He felt trapped. However hard he tried to regain the initiative, she hit back. And in the end he had no choice but to acknowledge that the balance of power had shifted, and shifted irreversibly. How crazy was that? He had taken her queen, but instead of building on that advantage, he had landed in a fatally weak position. Surely she had not deliberately sacrificed her queen so early in the game. That would be impossible. The sort of thing you read about in books. It doesn't happen in your local chess club in Vazastan, and it's definitely not something that pierced punk chicks with attitude problems do, especially not to great players like him. Yet there was no escape. In 4 or 5 moves he would be beaten, and so he saw no alternative but to knock over his king with his index finger and mumble congratulations. Even though he would have liked to serve up some excuses, something told him that that would make matters worse. He had a sneaking feeling that his defeat was not just down to bad luck, and almost against his will he began to feel frightened again. Who the hell was she? Cautiously he looked her in the eye, and now she no longer looked like a stroppy, insecure nobody. Now she seemed cold, like a predator eyeing its prey. He felt deeply ill at ease, as if the defeat on the chessboard were but a prelude to something much, much worse.
He glanced towards the door.
"You're not going anywhere," she said.
"Who are you?" he said.
"Nobody special."
"So we haven't met before?"
"Not exactly."
"But nearly, is that it?"
"We've met in your nightmares, Arvid."
"Is this some kind of joke?"
"Not really."
"What do you mean?"
"What do you think I mean?"
"How should I know?"
He could not understand why he was so scared. "Franz Palder was murdered last night," she said in a monotone.
"Well, yes, I read that," he stammered.
"Terrible, isn't it?"
"Awful."
"Especially for you, right?"
"Why especially for me?"
"Because you betrayed him, Arvid. Because you gave him the kiss of Judas." His body froze.
"That's bullshit," he spat out.
"As a matter of fact, it's not. I hacked your computer, cracked your encryption, and saw very clearly that you sold his technology to Solifon. And you know what?"
He was finding it hard to breathe.
"I'm sure you woke up this morning and wondered if his death was your fault. I can help you there. It was your fault. If you hadn't been so greedy and bitter and pathetic, Franz Balder would be alive now. I should warn you, that's making me pretty fucking angry, Arvid. I'm going to hurt you badly. First of all, by making you suffer the same sort of treatment you inflict on the women you find online.
Are you insane?"
"Probably, yes," she said. "Empathy deficit disorder, excessive violence, something along those lines."
She gripped his hand with a force which scared him out of his wits.
"Arvid, do you know what I'm doing right now?"
"No."
"I'm sitting here trying to decide what to do with you. I'm thinking in terms of suffering of biblical proportions. That's why I might seem a bit distracted."
"What do you want?"
"I want revenge. Haven't I made that clear?"
"You're talking crap."
"Definitely not, and I think you know it too, but there is a way out."
"What do I have to do?"
He could not understand why he said it. "What do I have to do?"
It was an admission, a capitulation, and he considered taking it back, putting pressure on her instead, to see if she had any proof, or if she was bluffing. But he could not bring himself to do it. Only later did he realize that it was not just the threats she tossed out or the uncanny strength of her hands. It was the game of chess, the queen's sacrifice. He was in shock, and something in his subconscious told him that a woman who plays like that must also know his secrets.
"What do I have to do?" he said again.
"You're going to follow me out of here, and you're going to tell me everything, Arvid. You're going to tell me exactly what happened when you sold out Franz Balder."
"It's a miracle," Boblansky said as he stood in Hanna Balder's kitchen, looking at the crumpled drawing which Blomqvist had plucked out of the rubbish.
"Let's not exaggerate," said Modig, who was standing right next to him.
She was right. It was not much more than some chess squares on a piece of paper, after all, and as Mikael Blomqvist had pointed out over the telephone, there was something strangely mathematical about the work, as if the boy were more interested in the geometry than in the threatening shadow above. But Boblansky was excited all the same. He had been told over and over how mentally impaired the Balder boy was, and how little he would be able to help them. Now the boy had produced a drawing which gave Boblansky more hope than anything else in the investigation. It strengthened his long-held conviction that one must never underestimate anyone or cling to preconceived ideas. They could not be certain that what August was illustrating was the moment of the murder. The shadow could at least in theory be associated with some other occasion, and there was no guarantee that the boy had seen the killer's face or that he would be able to draw it. And yet deep down that is what Boblansky believed, not just because the drawing, even in its present state, was masterful. He had studied the other drawings, too, in which you could see, beyond the street crossing and the traffic light, a shabby man with thin lips who had been caught red-handed, jaywalking. If you looked at it purely from a law enforcement point of view, he was crossing the street on a red. And Amanda Flood, another officer on the team, had recognized him straight away, as the out-of-work actor Roger Winter, who had convictions for drunk driving and assault. The photographic precision of August's eye ought to be a dream for any murder investigator, but Boblansky did realize that it would be unprofessional to set his hopes too high.
Maybe the murderer had been masked at the time of the killing, or his face had already faded from the child's memory. There were many possible scenarios, but Oblansky cast a glum look in the direction of Modig.
"You think it's wishful thinking on my part?" he said.
"For a man who is beginning to doubt the existence of God, you are surprisingly willing to hope for a miracle."
"Well, maybe."
"But it's worth getting to the bottom of. I agree with that," Modig said.
"Good. In that case, let's see the boy."
Boblansky went out of the kitchen and nodded at Hannah Balder, who was sunk in the living room sofa, fumbling with some tablets. Lisbeth Salander and Arvid Vranger came out into Vasaparken arm in arm, like a pair of old friends out for a stroll. Appearances can be deceptive. Vranger was terrified as Salander steered them towards a park bench. The wind was getting up again and the temperature creeping down. It was hardly a day for feeding the pigeons, and Vranger was cold. But Salander decided that the bench would do, and forced him to sit down, holding his arm in a vice-like grip.
"Right," she said, "let's make this quick."
"Will you keep my name out of it?"
"I'm promising nothing, Arvid. But your chances of being able to go back to your miserable life will increase significantly if you tell me every detail of what happened."
"Okay," he said. "Do you know Darknet?"
"I know it," she said.
No one knew Darknet like Lisbeth Salander. Darknet was the lawless undergrowth of the Internet. The only way to access it was with a specially encrypted software, and the user's anonymity was guaranteed. No one could Google your details or trace your activities online. So Darknet was full of drug dealers, terrorists, conmen, gangsters, illegal arms dealers, pimps, and black hats. If there was an Internet hell, then this was it. But Darknet was not in itself evil. Salander understood that better than anyone. These days, when spy agencies and the big software companies follow every step we take online, even honest people need a hiding place. Darknet was also a hub for dissidents, whistleblowers, and informants. Opposition forces could protest on Darknet out of reach of their government, and Salander had used it for her own more discreet investigations and attacks. She knew its sites and search engines, and its old-fashioned workings, far away from the known visible net.
"Did you put Balder's technology up for sale on Darknet?" she said.
"No. I was just casting about. I was pissed off. You know, France hardly even said hello to me. He treated me like dirt. And he didn't care about that technology of his either. It has the potential to make all of us rich, but he only wanted to play and experiment with it like a little kid. One evening when I'd had a few drinks, I just chucked out a question on a geek site. Who can pay good money for some revolutionary AI technology?"
"And did you get an answer?"
"It took a while. I had time to forget that I'd even asked. But in the end, someone calling himself Bogey wrote back with some well-informed questions. At first, my answers were ridiculously unguarded, but soon I realized what a mess I'd gotten myself into, and I became terrified that Bogey would steal the technology."
"Without you getting anything for it?"
"It was a dangerous game. To be able to sell France's technology, I had to tell people about it. But if I said too much, then I would already have lost it. Bogey flattered me rotten. In the end, he knew exactly where we were and what sort of software we were working on."
"He meant to hack you?"
"Presumably. He somehow managed to get hold of my name, and that floored me. I became totally paranoid and announced that I wanted to pull out, but by then it was too late. Not that Bogey threatened me, at least not directly. He just went on and on about how he and I were going to do great things together and earn masses of money. In the end, I agreed to meet him in Stockholm at a Chinese boat restaurant on Södra Mälarstrand. It was a windy day, I remember, and I stood there freezing. I waited more than half an hour, and afterwards I wondered if he had been checking me out in some way. But then he showed up. Yes, at first I didn't believe it was him. He looked like a junkie or a beggar, and if I hadn't seen that Patek Philippe watch on his wrist, I probably would have tossed him 20 kroner. He had amateur tattoos and dodgy-looking scars on his arms, which he waved about as he walked. He was carrying this awful-looking trench coat, and he seemed to have been more or less living on the streets. The strangest thing of all was that he was proud of it. It was only the watch,
and the handmade shoes which showed that he had at some point managed to raise himself out of the gutter. Other than that, he seemed keen to stick to his roots. Later on, when I'd given him everything and we were celebrating our deal over a few bottles of wine, I asked about his background. I hope for your sake that he gave you some details. If you want to track him down, I have to warn you, I don't want advice, Arvid. I want facts. Fine. He was careful, he said, but I still got a few things. He probably couldn't help himself. He grew up in a big city in Russia, though he didn't name it. He'd had everything stacked against him, he said. His mother was a whore and a heroin addict, and his father could have been anybody. As a small boy, he'd ended up in the orphanage from hell. There was some lunatic there, he told me, who used to make him lie on a butcher's slab in the kitchen and whipped him with a broken cane. When he was 11, he ran away and lived on the street. He stole, broke into cellars and stairwells to get a little warmth, got drunk on cheap vodka, sniffed glue and was abused and beaten. But he also discovered one thing. What? That he had talent. He was an expert at breaking and entering, which became his first source of pride, his first identity. He was capable of doing in just a few seconds what took others hours. Before that, he had been a homeless brat. Everyone had despised him and spat at him. Now he was the boy who could get himself in wherever he wanted. It became an obsession. All day long he dreamed of being some sort of Houdini in reverse. He didn't want to break out. He wanted to break in. He practiced for 10, 12, 14 hours a day, and in the end he was a legend on the streets. Or so he said. He started to carry out bigger operations, using computers he stole and reconfigured to hack in everywhere. He made a heap of money, which he blew on drugs, and often he was robbed or taken advantage of. He could be clear as a bell when he was on one of his jobs, but afterwards he would lie around in a narcotic haze, and someone would walk all over him. He was a genius and a total idiot at the same time, he said. But one day everything changed. He was saved, raised up out of his hell. How? He had been asleep in some dump of a place that was due to be pulled down, and when he opened his eyes and looked around in the yellowish light, there was an angel standing before him. An angel? That's what he said, an angel. And maybe it was partly the contrast with everything else in there, the syringes, the leftover food, the cockroaches. He said she was the most beautiful woman he had ever seen. He could scarcely look at her, and he got this idea that he was going to die. It was an ominous, solemn feeling. But the woman explained, as if it were the most natural thing in the world, that she would make him rich and happy. If I've understood it right, she kept her promise. She gave him new teeth, got him into rehab. She arranged for him to train as a computer engineer. So ever since he's been hacking computers and stealing for this woman and her network. That's right. He became a new person, or maybe not completely new. In many ways, he's still the same old thief and bum. But he no longer takes drugs, he says. And he spends all his free time keeping up to date with new technology. He finds a lot on Darknet, and he claims to be stinking rich. And the woman. Did he say anything more about her? No, he was extremely careful about that. He spoke in such evasive and respectful terms that I wondered for a while if she wasn't a fantasy or hallucination. But I reckon she really does exist. I could sense sheer physical fear when he was talking about her. He said that he would rather die than let her down, and then he showed me a Russian patriarchal cross made of gold which she had given him. One of those crosses, you know, which has a slanted beam down by the foot, one end pointing up and the other down. He told me this was a reference to the Gospel according to St. Luke, and the two thieves who were hanged next to Jesus on the cross. The one thief believes in Jesus and goes to heaven, the other mocks him and is thrust down into hell. That's what awaits you if you fail her. That's about it, yes. So she sees herself as Jesus? In this context, the cross probably has nothing to do with Christianity. It's the message she wants to pass on. Loyalty or the torments of hell? Something along those lines. Yet you're sitting here, Arvid, spilling the beans. I didn't see an alternative. I hope you got paid a lot. Well, yes. And then Baldur's technology was sold to Solifon and True Games. Yes, but I don't get it. Not when I think of it now. What don't you get? How could you know all this? Because you were dumb enough to send an email to Ekavolt at Solifon. Don't you remember? but I wrote nothing to suggest that I'd sold the technology. I was very careful about that.
What you said was enough for me, she said.
She got to her feet, and it was as if his entire being collapsed. Wait, what's going to happen now? Will you keep me out of it?
You can always hope, she said,
and walked off towards Odenplan with purposeful steps. Oblansky's mobile rang as he was on his way down to the front entrance on Torsgatan. It was Professor Edelman. Oblansky had been trying to reach him ever since he realized that the boy was a savant. Oblansky had found out online that two Swedish authorities were regularly quoted on this subject, Lena Ek at Lund University and Charles Edelman at the Karolinska Institute. But he had not been able to get hold of either, so he had postponed the search and gone off to see Hanna Balder. Now Edelman was ringing back, and he sounded shaken. He was in Budapest, he said, at a conference on heightened memory capacity. He had just arrived there and seen the news about the murder a moment ago on CNN.
"Otherwise I would have gotten in touch right away," he said.
"What do you mean?"
"Professor Balder rang me yesterday evening."
That made Boblansky jump.
"What did he want?"
"He wanted to talk about his son and his son's talent."
"Did you know each other?"
"Not in the slightest. He contacted me because he was worried about his boy, and I was stunned to hear from him."
"Why?"
"Because it was Franz Balder. He's a household name to us neurologists. We tend to say he's just like us in wanting to understand the brain. The only difference is that he also wants to build one."
"I've heard something about that."
"I'd been told that he was an introverted and difficult man, a bit like a machine himself, people sometimes used to joke. Nothing but logic circuits. But with me he was incredibly emotional, and it shocked me, to be honest. It was, I don't know, as if you were to hear your toughest policeman cry. I remember thinking that something must have happened, something other than what we were talking about."
"That sounds right." He had finally accepted that he was under a serious threat, Boblansky said.
"But he also had reason to be excited. His son's drawings were apparently exceptionally good, and that's not common at all at that age, not even with savants, and especially not in combination with proficiency in mathematics."
"Mathematics?"
"Yes, according to Balder, his son had mathematical skills too. I could spend a long time talking about that."
"What do you mean?"
"Because I was utterly amazed, and at the same time maybe not so amazed after all. We now know that there's a hereditary factor in savants, and here we have a father who is a legend thanks to his advanced algorithms. But still, artistic and numerical talents do not usually present themselves together in these children."
"Surely the great thing about life is that every now and then it springs a surprise on us," Boblansky said.
"True, Chief Inspector. So what can I do for you?"
Boblansky thought through everything that had happened in Saltsjöbaden, and it struck him that it would do no harm to be cautious.
"All I can say is that we need your help and expert knowledge as a matter of urgency."
"The boy was a witness to the murder, was he not?"
"Yes."
"And you want me to try to get him to draw what he saw?"
"I'd prefer not to comment."
Charles Edelman was standing in the lobby of the Hotel Boscolo in Budapest, a conference centre not far from the glittering Danube. The place looked like an opera house, with magnificent high ceilings, old-fashioned cupolas and pillars. He had been looking forward to the week here, the dinners and the presentations. Yet he was agitated and ran his fingers through his hair.
"Unfortunately, I'm not in a position to help you. I have to give an important lecture tomorrow morning," he had said to Boblansky, and that was true. He had been preparing the talk for some weeks, and he was going to take a controversial line with several eminent memory experts. He recommended a young associate professor, Martin Forkus, to Boblansky.
But as soon as he hung up and exchanged looks with a colleague who had paused next to him holding a sandwich, he began to have regrets. He even began to envy young Martin Forkus, who was not yet 35, always looked far too good in photographs, and on top of it all was beginning to make a name for himself. It was true that Edelman did not fully understand what had happened. The police inspector had been cryptic, and was probably worried that someone might be listening in on the call. Yet the professor still managed to grasp the bigger picture. The boy was good at drawing, and was a witness to a murder. That could mean only one thing, and the longer Edelman thought about it, the more he fretted.
He would be giving many more important lectures in his life, but he would never get another chance to play a part in a murder investigation at this level. However he looked at the assignment he had so casually passed on to Vorgas, it was bound to be much more interesting than anything he might be involved in here in Budapest. Who knows? It could even make him some sort of celebrity. He visualized the headline. Prominent neurologist helps police solve murder. Or better still, Edelman's research leads to breakthrough in murder hunt. How could he be so stupid as to turn it down? He picked up his mobile and called Chief Inspector Boblansky again. Boblansky hung up. He and Modig had managed to park not far from the Stockholm Public Library and had just crossed the street. Once again the weather was dreadful and Boblansky's hands were freezing.
"Did he change his mind?" Modig said.
"Yes, he's going to shelve his lecture."
"When can he be here?"
"He's looking into it. Tomorrow morning at the latest." They were on their way to Odin's medical centre on Sveavägen to meet the director, Torkel Lindén. The meeting was only meant to settle the practical arrangements for August Balder's testimony, at least as far as Boblansky was concerned, but even though Torkel Lindén did not yet know the true purpose of their visit, he had been strangely discouraging over the telephone and said that right now the boy was not to be disturbed. "In any way." Boblansky had sensed an instinctive hostility, and was not particularly pleasant in return. It had not been a promising start. Lindén turned out not to be the hefty figure Boblansky had expected. He was hardly more than 5 feet tall and had short, possibly dyed black hair and pinched lips. He wore black jeans, a black polo sweater, and a small cross on a ribbon around his neck. There was something ecclesiastical about him, and his hostility was genuine. He had a haughty look, and Boblansky became aware of his own Jewishness, which happened whenever he encountered this sort of malevolence and air of moral superiority. Lindén wanted to show that he was better, because he put the boy's physical well-being first, rather than offering him up for police purposes. Boblansky saw no choice but to be as amiable as possible.
"Pleased to meet you," he said.
"Is that so?" Lindén said.
"Oh, yes. And it's kind of you to see us at such short notice. We really wouldn't come barging in like this if we didn't think this matter was of the utmost importance.
I imagine you want to interview the boy in some way."
"Not exactly," Boblansky said, not quite so amiably. "I have to emphasize, first of all, that what I'm saying now must remain between us. It's a question of security."
"Confidentiality is a given for us. We have no loose lips here," Lindén said,
in such a way as to suggest that it was the opposite with the police. "My only concern is for the boy's safety," Boblansky said sharply.
"So that's your priority?"
"As a matter of fact, yes," the policeman said with even greater severity. "And that is why none of what I'm about to tell you must be passed on in any way, least of all by email or by telephone. Can we sit somewhere private?"
Sonia Modig did not think much of the place, but then she was probably affected by the crying. Somewhere nearby a little girl was sobbing relentlessly. They were sitting in a room which smelled of detergent and also of something else, maybe a lingering trace of incense. A cross hung on the wall and there was a worn teddy bear lying on the floor. Not much else made the place cosy or attractive, and since Boblansky, usually so good-natured, was about to lose his temper, she took matters into her own hands and gave a calm, factual account of what had happened.
"We are given to understand," she said, "that your colleague, Einar Forsberg, said that August should not be allowed to draw."
"That was his professional judgment, and I agree with it. It doesn't do the boy any good," Lindén said.
"Well, I don't see how anything could do him much good under these circumstances. He saw his father being killed."
"We don't want to make things any worse, do we?"
"True, but this drawing August was not allowed to finish could lead to a breakthrough in the investigation, and therefore I'm afraid we must insist. We'll make sure there are people present with the necessary expertise."
"I still have to say no."
Modi could hardly believe her ears.
"With all due respect for your work," Lindén went on doggedly, "here at Odense we help vulnerable children. That's our job and our calling. We're not an extension of the police force. That's how it is. And we're proud of it.
for as long as the children are here, they should feel confident that we put their interests first.
Modig laid a restraining hand on Boblansky's thigh.
We can easily get a court order, she said, but we'd prefer not to go that route.
Wise of you.
Let me ask you something, she said. Are you and Forsberry so absolutely sure what's best for August? Or for the girl crying over there, for that matter? Couldn't it be that we all need to express ourselves? You and I can talk, or write, or even go out and get a lawyer. August doesn't have those means of expression. But he can draw, and he seems to want to tell us something. Shouldn't we let August give form to something which must be tormenting him?
In our judgment,
no, she cut him off. Don't tell us about your judgment. We're in contact with the person who knows more than anyone else in this country about this particular condition. His name is Charles Edelman. He's a professor of neurology, and he's on his way here from Hungary to meet the boy.
We can, of course, listen to him,
Linden said reluctantly. Not just listen. We let him decide.
I promise to engage in a constructive dialogue between experts.
Fine. What's August doing now?
He's sleeping. He was exhausted when he came to us.
Modi could tell that nothing good would come of it, were she to suggest that the boy be woken up.
In that case, we'll come back tomorrow morning with Professor Edelman, and I hope that we can all work together on this matter.
Chapter 16, November 21st to 22nd. Gabriella Grana buried her face in her hands. She had not been to bed for 40 hours, and she was racked by a deep sense of guilt, only made worse by the lack of sleep. Yet she had been working hard all day long. Since this morning she had been part of a team at SEPO, a sort of shadow unit which was investigating in secret every detail of the Franz Balder murder under cover of looking into broader domestic policy implications. Superintendent Morten Nielsen was formerly leading the team and had recently returned from a year of study at the University of Maryland in the United States. He was undoubtedly intelligent and well-informed, but too right-wing for Grana's tastes. It was rare to find a well-educated Swede who was also a wholehearted supporter of the American Republican Party. He even expressed some sympathy for the Tea Party movement. He was passionate about military history and lectured the Kalbury Military Academy. Although still young, 39, he was believed to have extensive international contacts. He often had trouble, however, asserting himself in the group, and in practice the real leader was Ragnar Olofsson, who was older and cockier, and could silence Nielsen with one peevish little sigh or a displeased wrinkle above his bushy eyebrows. Nor was Nielsen's life made any easier by the fact that Detective Inspector Lars Åke Grankvist was also on the team. Before joining the security police, Grankvist had been a semi-legendary investigator in the Swedish police's National Murder Squad, at least in the sense that he was said to be able to drink anybody else under the table, and to manage, with a sort of boisterous charm, to keep a lover in every town. It was not an easy group in which to hold one's own, and Grana kept an ever lower profile as the afternoon wore on. But this was due less to the men and their macho rivalry than to a growing sense of uncertainty. Sometimes she wondered if she knew even less now than before. She realized, for example, that there was little or no proof to support the theory of the suspected data breach. All they had was a statement from Stefan Molder at the NDRE, and not even he had been sure of what he was saying. In her view, his analysis was more or less rubbish. Balder seems to have relied primarily on the female hacker he had turned to for help, the woman not even named in the investigation, but whom his assistant, Linus Brandel, had described in such vivid terms. It was likely that Balder had been withholding a lot from Grana before he left for America. For example, was it a coincidence that he had found a job at Solifon? The uncertainty gnawed at her, and she was indignant that no help was coming from Fort Meade. She could not get hold of Alona Casales, and the NSA was once again a closed door, so she in turn no longer passed on any news. Just like Nielsen and Grankvist, she found herself overshadowed by Olofsson. He kept getting information from his source at the Violent Crimes Division, and immediately passing it on to the head of SEPO, Helena Kraft. Grana did not like it, and in vain she had pointed out that this traffic
not only increased the risk of a leak, but also seemed to be costing them their independence. Instead of searching their own channels, they were slavishly relying on the information which flowed in from Oblansky's team.
"We're like people cheating on an exam, waiting for someone to whisper the answer instead of thinking for ourselves," she had said to the team, and this had not made her popular.
Now she was alone in her office, determined to move ahead on her own, trying to see the bigger picture. It might get her nowhere, but on the other hand, it would do no harm. She heard steps outside in the corridor, the click-clack of determined high heels which Grana by now recognized only too well. It was Kraft, who came in wearing a grey Armani jacket, her hair pulled into a tight bun. Kraft gave her an affectionate look, but there were times when Grana resented this favouritism.
"How's it going?"
Kraft asked.
"Are you surviving?"
"Just about.
I'm going to send you home after this conversation. You have to get some sleep. We need an analyst with a clear head."
"Sounds sensible."
"Do you know what Eric Maria Remarque said?"
"That it's not much fun in the trenches, or something."
"Ha! No, that it's always the wrong people who have the guilty conscience. Those who are really responsible for suffering in the world couldn't care less. It's the ones fighting for good who are consumed by remorse. You've got nothing to be ashamed of, Gabriella. You did what you could."
"I'm not so sure about that.
But thanks, anyway. Have you heard about Baldur's son?"
"Just very quickly, from Ragnar."
"At 10 tomorrow morning, Chief Inspector Bublansky, Detective Sergeant Modig, and a Professor Edelman will be seeing the boy at Odin's Medical Center for Children and Adolescents on Sveavegan. They're going to try and get him to draw some more."
"I'll keep my fingers crossed."
"But I'm not too happy to know about it." "Relax. Leave the paranoia to me. The only ones who know about this are people who can keep their traps shut."
"I suppose you're right."
"I want to show you something. Photographs of the man who hacked Baldur's burglar alarm."
"I've seen them already. I've even studied them in detail."
"Have you?"
Kraft said, handing over an enlarged and blurred picture of a wrist.
"What about it?" "Take another look."
"What do you see?" Grana looked and saw two things. The luxury watch she had noted before, and, beneath it, barely distinguishable between the glove and the jacket cuff, a couple of lines which looked like amateur tattoos.
"Contrasts," she said. "Some cheap tattoos and a very expensive watch." "More than that," Kraft said. "That's a 1951 Patek Philippe, model 2499, first series, or just, possibly, second series."
"Means nothing to me."
"It's one of the finest wristwatches in the world. A few years ago, a watch like this sold at auction at Christie's in Geneva for more than $2 million.
"Are you kidding?"
"No. And it wasn't just anyone who bought it. It was Jan van der Waal, a lawyer at Dackstone and Partner. He bid for it on behalf of a client."
"Dackstone and Partner. Don't they represent Solifon?"
"Correct. We don't know whether the watch on the surveillance photo is the one that was sold in Geneva, and we haven't been able to find out who that client was, but it's a start, Gabriella. A scrawny type who looks like a junkie and who wears a watch of this calibre. That should narrow the field."
"Does Bublansky know this?"
"It was his technical expert, Jerka Holmberry, who discovered it. Now I want you and your analytical brain to take it further. Go home, get some sleep, and get started on it in the morning."
The man who called himself Jan Holzer was sitting at home in his apartment on Högsbergsgatan in Helsinki, not far from Esplanaden Park, looking through an album of photographs of his daughter Olga, who was now 22 and studying medicine in Gdansk. Olga was tall and dark and intense and, as he had a habit of saying, the best thing that ever happened to him. Not just because it sounded good, he believed it. But now Olga had come to suspect what he was actually doing.
"Are you protecting evil people?"
she had asked him one day, before embarking on a manic pursuit of what she called her commitment to the weak and vulnerable. It was pure pinko left-wing lunacy, in Holzer's opinion, not at all in keeping with Olga's character. He saw it as her attempt to stake out her independence. Behind all the talk about beggars, he thought she was still quite like him. Once upon a time, Olga had been a promising 100-meter runner. She was 6 feet tall, muscular, and explosive, and in the old days she had loved watching action films and listening to him reminisce about the war in Chechnya. Everyone at school had known better than to pick a fight with her. She hit back, like a warrior. Olga was definitely not cut out to minister to the sick and degenerate. Yet she claimed to want to work for Médecins Sans Frontières, or go off to Calcutta like some Mother Teresa. Holzer could not bear the thought. The world belongs to the strong, he felt. But he loved his daughter, however daft some of her ideas, and tomorrow she was coming home for the first time in 6 months, for a few days' leave. He solemnly resolved that he would be a better listener this time, and not pontificate about Stalin and great leaders and everything that she hated. He would instead try to bring them closer again. He was certain that she needed him. At least he was pretty sure that he needed her. It was 8 in the evening, and he went into the kitchen and pressed 3 oranges and poured Smirnoff into a glass. It was his 3rd screwdriver of the day. Once he had finished a job, he could put away 6 or 7 of them, and maybe he would do that now. He was tired, weighed down by all the responsibility on his shoulders, and he needed to relax. For a few minutes he stood with his drink in his hand and dreamed about a different sort of life. But the man who called himself Jan Holzer had set his hopes too high. The tranquillity came to an abrupt end as Bogdanov rang on his secure mobile. At first Holzer hoped that Bogdanov just wanted to chat, to release some of the excitement that came with every assignment, but his colleague was calling about a very specific matter, and sounded less than happy.
"I've spoken to T," he said.
Holzer felt a number of things all at once, perhaps jealousy most of all. Why did Kira ring Bogdanov and not him? Even if it was Bogdanov who brought in the big money and was rewarded accordingly, Holzer had always been convinced that he was the one closer to Kira. But Holzer was also worried. Had something gone wrong after all? "Is there a problem?" he said.
"The job isn't finished."
"Where are you?"
"In town."
"Come on up in that case and explain what the hell you mean."
"I booked a table at Postre."
"I don't feel like going to some posh restaurant. Get yourself over here."
"I haven't eaten."
"I'll fry something up."
"Sounds good. We've got a long night ahead of us."
Holzer did not want another long night. Still less did he feel like telling his daughter that he would not be at home the next day. But he had no choice. He knew as surely as he knew that he loved Olga, you could not say no to Kira. She wielded some invisible power, and however hard he tried, he could never be as dignified in her presence as he wanted. She reduced him to a little boy, and often he turned himself inside out, just to see her smile. Kira was staggeringly beautiful, and knew how to make the most of it, like no other beauty before her. She was unmatched when it came to power games. She knew all the moves. She could be weak and needy when it suited, but also indomitable, hard, and cold as ice, and sometimes plain evil. Nobody brought out the sadist in him like she did. She may not have been intelligent in the conventional sense, and many pointed that out to try to take her down a peg or two, but the same people were still stupefied in her presence. Kira played them like a violin, and could reduce even the toughest of men to blushing and giggling schoolchildren. It was 9 p.m., and Bogdanov was sitting next to him shoveling in the lamb chop Holzer had prepared. Oddly enough, his table manners were almost passable. That may have been Kira's influence. In many ways Bogdanov had become quite civilized, and then again not. However he tried to put on airs, he could never entirely rid himself of the appearance of the petty thief and speed addict. He had been off drugs for ages and was a computer engineer with university qualifications, but still looked ravaged by street life.
"Where's your bling watch?" Holzer said. "Are you in the doghouse?"
"We both are."
"It's that bad?"
"Maybe not."
"The job isn't finished, you said?"
"No, it's that boy."
"Which boy?"
Holzer pretended not to understand.
"The one you so nobly spared."
"What about him? He's a retard, you know."
"Maybe so. But he can draw."
"What do you mean, draw?"
"He's a savant."
"A what?"
"You should try reading something other than your fucking gun magazines for once."
"What are you talking about?"
"It's someone who's autistic or handicapped in some other way, but who has a special gift. This boy may not be able to talk or think like a normal person,
but he has a photographic memory. The police think the little bastard is going to be able to draw your face, and then they're going to run it through their facial recognition software, and then you're screwed, aren't you? You must be there somewhere in Interpol's records. Yes, but Kira can't expect us to...
That's exactly what she expects.